and welcome to episode 14 of The Coriolis Effect, kickstarting the new year. I'm Dave.
And I'm Matthew. And today we've got the last three segments of our interview that we did way back in November, Dave. Most of this podcast is going to focus on those three segments of interview. But around that, we've got some news from the wider world of gaming. And that's going to include a bit of a chat about our attendance at Dragon Meet. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that comes up in the interview. And we're going to tell you what's happening in our next episode, episode 15, when things get somewhat back to normal.
Yeah, we've been away a little bit for these last few weeks over Christmas. So sorry for having a relatively long spell without anything coming out. Christmas and all the rest of it, you know what life is like. It gets in the way sometimes, but we will be getting ourselves...
Well, nothing came out. I snuck out a little 5-minute episode while you weren't looking.
Well, I know, which is fine. Well done. You should, you know, let's collaborate on these things in future, maybe, you know. No, that was good. Glad to get that out, because I did feel a little bit like we were struggling to find the time to get anything out. But I think absolutely in the new year, we will get ourselves back to our normal routine. We'll have pretty much got all the interview, certainly the Swedish interviews we had, played out for you all to have a listen to. And we can get ourselves back to our normal discussion, bantering sort of routine with more of me and Matthew, which is clearly, I think, what our listeners really want.
Yes. Well, according to the survey, that's partly true. Every part of what we've done so far has been popular with some people. If you remember, I had a question that I asked people to rank every element of the content that we've put out so far, as whether it was their favourite or least favourite in order. And it was really good to see that pretty much everything had somebody liking it as their favourite thing. And similarly, pretty much everything had people saying it was their least favourite. So it feels to me that the mix of what we're putting out so far is meeting everybody's differing needs, and we should carry on pretty much as we're doing. There was a little bit of demand for a bit more discussion of stuff that's happening in the world of Third Horizon, and some dissection of some of the fluff material that's in the book. So I think we might start talking a bit about that a bit more.
Well, I think that's pretty much sort of what we'd been thinking of doing anyway for some time, isn't it? I mean, the discussions we've had over a number of episodes around Zalos, for example, has, I think, fitted that really well. But I'm more than happy to, you know, keep a closer focus on some of that Horizon setting material, and, you know, make sure that we don't go off-piste too much into areas that perhaps might be a bit less interesting to, you know, to the majority of our listeners.
Yeah. So we'll do some more of that. We'll be doing that really from the next episode, because most of this episode, as I've said, is going to be talking or listening to the last bits of our interview with Freya Lagan.
Yeah, but before we get there, I think we let's have a little reflection on Dragon Meet, which is now about a month away, is a month ago when we were there. Feels a lot longer with Christmas and that in the way. But I just wanted to say, for my first Dragon Meet, and I say I hadn't been to a games convention in a big one for a number of years, it was really good, and the event was really well organised and really well populated. There was loads of people there. We both ran a Coriolis game in the morning, and I would just like to say a great big thank you to Paul, Jeff, Mikhail, Doug and Stuart, who were my five players playing my scenario, which was called All Our Yesterdays, just for really getting stuck in and making it a really great game.
I heard a report that they really enjoyed it. I heard that a little bit, sadly, from somebody who thinks she might have been had more fun with their scenario, with your scenario, than with mine. So I think I have to admit, here and now, the argument has been settled. You are the best GM, Dan.
It has been settled. I am the best GM. Yes.
Well, not that was any surprise, actually, to me.
You know. Well, it was to me, you can be sure of that. But next year, maybe I will reclaim my title as the best GM. We'll have to wait and see. Yeah, thanks to everybody that played in both our games and just came to chat to us. It's the first time I've ever been at a convention where somebody's come up to me as a kind of actual fan. So a shout out to Jana from the London Role Playing Club, who came and had a chat with me quite early on in the day, and it's really nice that people out there are coming to talk to us.
And I
think we'll probably, if there's a podcast zone again next year, we'll probably go again.
Yeah, I'm sure we would. Absolutely. You know, it was a really good opportunity to meet a lot of those podcasters who are our peers, our contemporaries, and to learn a lot from them, because they've obviously been doing podcasts for a long time. They've all got a lot of experience, and it was great to chat to a few other guys and girls there and, you know, take away some stuff that is going to hopefully make our podcasts a little bit better, even if that's possible, he says, full of himself.
Yeah. Well, you know, if I can find a better co-presenter, then obviously we will improve our podcast. But for the time being, we'll have to just see if we can upskill you a bit.
Well, unfortunately, I do have to stop this podcast in about 10 minutes. I've got a number of people arriving who are interviewing. I'm interviewing them for the co-podcaster role. So actually, you better get on with it, because otherwise you'll be out first.
Right. Okay. Well,
anyway.
Is there anything else we want to say about Dragon Meat? I bought a nice couple of trays, but I didn't buy very much, actually.
No, I didn't buy.
I wonder whether that's because we've got so much on order with Kickstarter and things.
No, I didn't buy anything, I don't think, on the day, but it was great. We had a great chance to have a good chat to Lloyd Guyan from Modiphius and interview him briefly. And the creator behind Nibiru, Federico, we had a great chance to chat to him and hear a little bit about his game that's going to be kickstarted sometime later this year. And I think we'll put those interviews out, not on this podcast, but next time and the time
maybe
after.
Maybe in the next episode.
But that was great. A really good chance just to network a little bit and meet a few like-minded people who, it's always great to talk to other gamers, particularly creative gamers who are doing things.
And of course, it was great as well to meet all the other podcasters in the podcast zone and actually join their podcast as well.
Yeah.
I don't think we appeared on the Release podcast, did we at all?
No, we didn't, unfortunately.
No, so but Callum from the Release organises the whole the podcast zone bit. And he helped us interview Lloyd Guyan. He loaned us his fancy bike and, in fact, took us to Federico and persuaded us to interview him as well. So we should give Callum great praise for that.
Absolutely.
But we appeared in a session, didn't we, that was really good fun, a very short D&D session that we had with the Formal Gamers.
Yeah, the Formal Gamers ran this game 8 or 10 times with different groups, and it was really great fun. It was just really silly, and the guys just ran it really, really well. My brother, Tony, who was with us, was able to join us, so Matthew, me and Tony were all involved, and really recommend that people go off and have a listen to the Formal Gamers. You might catch us, but you'll obviously catch a lot of other really great stuff as well.
Yeah, you'll hear everybody's different approaches. It was the same problem, and it was an interesting, quite surreal problem.
It was entirely surreal, the problem.
But like all the best GMs, they hadn't pre-written the solution, so I think everybody took different solutions in. And actually, we were maybe the more traditional D&D players in that we just hit the bad guys with stuff until they died.
Well, it seemed to work, didn't it?
But it seemed to do the job for us. But our journey there was kind of an interesting one, so it is worth listening to. And they're the GMs, or they're the sort of GMs that I really admire, who can do voices. So,
Even though the Elvis impression wasn't supposed to be Elvis, but it did sound just like Elvis.
Was it not supposed to be Elvis?
I don't think so, no.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Because you did say thank you very much. Anyway, never mind. We leave that to our listeners. Listen to the Formal Gamers podcast from Dragon Meat and decide for yourself whether we actually met Elvis or not. And also, after you left, Dave, I had an interview.
Well, you had a quick chat with the Critical Twits.
Critical Twits.
Yeah. Excellent.
And so they were interviewing, I think, about 12 other podcasters for their episode, which is out now. It came out, dropped on the 5th of December. They left me to last because, frankly, I'm the best. and I really sold Coriolis to them. Within their gaming group, somebody had expressed an interest in the game, and so I took this as an opportunity not to talk about me, which I hardly ever do anyway because I'm a modest sort of guy. but to talk the game and how much fun they'd have playing it. So if anybody out there is needing a little bit of external evidence to stick under somebody's nose, a reluctant player's nose, to get them to join your Coriolis game, get them to listen to episode 91, I think it is, of Critical Twits, and you'll hear me bang on about it for ages.
Talking about banging on, we've seen the early drafts of three chapters of the Forbidden Lands Kickstarter, which came up, well, I think just
earlier today,
yesterday or this morning, I think it was, yeah. So now you've had a better chance to have a quick look at it than I have. I had a quick glance through it earlier. Really good to see this stuff coming through. But what were your first impressions, Matt?
I can't say I've read it properly yet, but it's nice to get something like this draft, which is not just a draft of the text, which it could easily have been, because, of course, the translation from Swedish to English is taking a little bit more time, I think, than they planned, so they weren't able to show us as much as they really wanted. But what they have shown us is laid out, and there's a real old-school feel to it, as we were promised. But the rules are pretty much the Zero Engine rules that we know and love from Coriolis. I've only kind of skim read it, but I've noticed some distinct problems solved and issues that we've discussed, like, you know, our slight reluctance to put in stone a character's problem, which in Forbidden Land is called Dark Secret, and you know, we've had a discussion about whether we're ready to do that right at the beginning of character generation or whether it's something that might appear during play. Well, here they've made it really explicit. If something comes up that's better during play, just swap it out. Make the thing you've discovered in play your dark secret. Don't be beholden to what you thought of when you were first creating a character. That's nice to see.
I had a really good example of that yesterday evening, in fact, when I ran the latest scenario in the Spectral Corsair campaign, where this is going to be a bit of a spoiler, actually, so I won't say this. I'll say this another time. But one of the characters...
Say it out of context. Go ahead.
But one of the characters...
They'll have forgotten by next month.
Possibly. One of the characters, I won't tell you who, a new character in the group, had started with a problem of the Legion is after them. They are a Legion Nakatra, and... but they've been nerfed, so they've had problems, but they're still quite powerful. So the Nakatra, if you look them up on page 330-something, are really quite powerful. But he had this, the Legion are after me, because he's formerly, you know, created and bred by the Legion. But anyway, during the game, they ended up getting into a fight, and he attacked one of these people and rolled a 66 on his critical hit and with using his teeth. And in effect, I'm sure everyone's seen... the classic old movie, The American Werewolf in London, and at the end,
if they haven't, they should go and see it.
They should go and see it, exactly. Well, not now, in about an hour when we've finished blathering on.
Yes.
But in that film, at the end, the werewolf is cornered. He attacks a policeman as he's trying to escape, and there's a shot of the policeman's head bouncing down the road and off a car's bonnet and stuff. That's what happened to this guy's head when the Nakatra attacked him. So he immediately changed his problem to bloodlust, or loves the taste of blood, which I thought was really good. He hadn't gone into it to kill the guy, but the 66 critical obviously was going to be pretty damn fatal. But yeah, so that was just a little aside about how this kind of thing works. And I think for Dark Secret, I think that's an excellent idea to to make that a bit more formal and get it in the front of people's minds that if you've got a bit of a crap problem and you want to change it, actually don't worry about it. Particularly if something in the game makes you think, oh, that's an incident that would lead to that problem. Well, yeah, just change it. That sounds like a great idea.
And there's another lovely thing I like about it, which is, as they told us, and I think you'll discover them telling us this in episode 13's interviews, they really wanted, because this was an old school game, to include other polyhedral dice.
Yes.
And one of the ways in which they do that is you can get a D12 for your pride. and your pride is the thing that you do best, and you can describe it any way you want to. So if you're a rogue, you might say, I'm the sneakiest rogue there is, the most silent infiltrator, whatever. And that's your pride. And at during the game, when you've got a really tough sneaking challenge, you can say, well, I'm going to invoke my pride here. And you bring out your D12 and you add that to the dice pool. And of course, it's really easy to score a 6 or higher on a D12. You've got, I think, 50-50 chance of getting a 6. Or even, is it? Anyway.
Slightly better, isn't it? Yeah.
Slightly better than 50. Yeah, 50, yeah. So you roll that, and hopefully you succeed. But, and I love this little mechanic, if you don't succeed, you can't have that pride anymore. Because you just proved you weren't the sneakiest sneaky thing.
Yeah.
And so you have to drop that and then play the next scenario with no pride at all. Then you choose another one and you get a D12 back on what you've decided is the other thing you're best at. I love that.
I love the mechanic.
I love the fact that it's about somebody's, you can imagine people bragging that they're the sneakiest sneak thief there is, but not actually being quite as good at that. So I'd love to see how that plays out, but I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that sounds excellent. I like that, yeah.
So, we've only seen the first 3 chapters, which talks about character creation, it talks about the world, and it talks about the skills and the dice mechanics. There are no darkness points in this game. It's more like the dice mechanics from Mutant Year Zero, which you're familiar with, Dave.
Yeah.
So more chance of breaking stuff, breaking your weapon or yourself if you roll ones. There is, though, a little bit like when you push the dice, you get mutant points, don't you?
Well, I think that's going to be magic points, however they term it.
Well, it's going to be will points.
Is it will? Is it? Okay.
And the will points is what you use to power your magic.
Yeah. So that's fine. That's very similar to the mutant point powering your mutations in Mutant Year Zero, which is fine. It's a really good mechanism. In Mutant Year Zero, there is danger in generating those points. You have to push yourself in order to get them. And that obviously carries an inherent danger of damaging yourself and breaking yourself, which is, again, it's a nice tension. And seeing that that mechanic brought into Forbidden Lands in the way that it is, I think that's great. It's really good because it's a nice mechanic in Mutant. I think it's going to work really nicely in Forbidden Lands.
I think now, don't quote me on this, because as I say, I've only skim read it, but I think it's slightly different in that you only get will points when you roll ones.
Okay.
So it's only when you do actually do damage to yourself or your weapon that you get your will points, I think. So it's not the risk of going for them, but it's almost a reward or rather a quid pro quo, should we say, in terms of taking whatever the damage is that you do from getting your ones. But yeah, we'll look in more detail at that maybe in the next episode, or we'll have some more information by then or the episode after.
And I need to scrub
we
up.
We ought to really.
I need to scrub up a little bit on my Mutant Year Zero, because that actually might be the way it works in Mutant Year Zero, but it has been over a year since I've played it now, because I've been playing Coriolis instead. But
yes.
so we can clarify that one for next time. But yes, we really ought to move on and get ourselves introduced into the next part of the interview with the Free League guys.
Yeah, and this bit of the interview starts when we ask them about the Open Gaming License.
So in the Forbidden Lands Kickstarter, you promised us as a stretch goal the Year Zero Engine Open Game License.
Yeah, we did, actually.
What do you expect to get out of that? Well, that's not what you expect. What do you hope to see?
To be completely honest, so we was someone in the comment section that suggested that.
It was me.
Was it you? It was me. Yeah. Hey, we were like, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. So
actually, you think this is a bad idea? If you want to lynch him, I'll just step out. Yeah.
So my question, I'll turn it back to you. What's that? No.
I think it's because I was going, I want to put so much of this stuff out.
Yeah, so I mean, Dave can see an opportunity here to do the thing game. Obviously,
yeah. Things like the thing game.
You'll have to, you know, you haven't got John Carpenter's approval for that.
That's why it's called Tango Tango 82, not the thing. You know.
I think it's more of a case of why not. I mean, people already hack stuff. I mean, there's people doing Warhammer fancy roleplay hacks of Year Zero and so on. There's some guy doing Star Wars every year, right. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And it's like, if some people enjoy the system, why not give them the tools to do it? I mean, it's not that complicated. It's not a big thing that we're going to make any money off, but it's, I mean, part of the RPG thing is people creating their own stuff.
Yeah.
So why not?
So just, and this is a technical point, maybe this will be too boring for this podcast, so we might cut this out. But I'm kind of interested in this, in that...
That's a really good opening line.
Yeah, you're summoning this.
Sounds great.
This is the boring bit, guys. Hungry.
So I can see Dave, he can get away with sticking his Tango Tango 82 under the terms of your OGL onto Drive-Thru and selling a few copies.
Yeah.
Well, you never know.
But I'm aware of the fact the only game that you own outright, including all the IP, is Forbidden Lands.
Yeah.
And now, if I want to make some stuff for Coriolis, are you going to be able to give me that permission?
That's actually something we're talking about. And to be honest, the final word is not said, but I think what we're going to go with is you can't put the Coriolis logo on front. You can't say this is Coriolis products, because that would be obviously a fall under the IP. But what you can say, this is on the back, maybe you can have a logo. This is compatible with Year Zero engine, which includes this and this and this and this. So you can't, but you can't produce actual.
You should have said no, Lisa. No.
Would have been easier. Would have been
But it's, I mean, this is a legal issue. I mean, we have figured it out. But it's.
I guess the key thing is about making sure that people aren't passing stuff off that then others think is stuff you've done, might not come to your standards.
Exactly. And I think that what we talked about, at least internally, is that you can't put the game logo on the front page. But you can't put, I think Savage Worlds does this or something. You have on the back, this is a Savage Worlds product. You can use it with this. Mm. It's not official, but it's compatible. And,
so what are you planning?
Dave's pretty much got something ready to run. I'm kind of, I like you guys do, messing around with worlds. I add bits to worlds as opposed to invent a world myself. That's what I like doing.
Let somebody else do all the creative heavy lifting, and then you just
you're missing a man.
But that's what we always did. We created part of a setting.
I think it's good to build up on someone else's. I think it's great. Forbidden Lands is our first original IP, and that's for a reason, because we like to build upon other people's existing structures. Because if we do that, we find we can. If we focus on this, if we do that, Mutant is the prime example of this. We changed the focus of the game, and it turned out pretty good. And we want to bring back the post-apocalyptic feeling to the game instead of because
cyberpunk and all. But
the former Swedish version was more like steampunk.
So you were in cities. It was working class against the aristocracy. Went to the Zoom.
It was a cool game, but zone. you never saw the waste.
What's that? No, so it was kind of different.
Yeah.
So are you done on the Year Zero engine, Dave?
Was there anything else? On the kind of fan creation stuff, one thing that we were talking about on one of the podcasts was the arc concept from Mutant. But swinging that into Coriolis.
Yeah.
Cool. Colony.
So we've had quite a lot of, discussion about it, and sort of came to the conclusion that we've found in the campaigns that we're running so far that our players just head off into the black, and they're gone a long way away from any any space station or planet yeah. base. Ooh. So it might not have the same kind of Mutant Year Zero feel, where you don't then go too far from your arc, because you'll be dead before you get back. But it then kind of brought up the idea of, is there something else? You know, is there a dynamic we could have whereby you have a colony ship or a ship that is a community that you are going around with that forms that? Yeah. Or, and we were then talking about, well, you've probably got ideas for what Nadia is and where it is and all the rest of it. But whether... we were just like riffing on the plane today, coming over, about, well, maybe because Coriolis, because Zenith was created in Coriolis in relatively easy form, perhaps these ships were built in modular way. And actually, in that era, on the way to the Third Horizon, has broken up into all its constituent parts. So you've got hundreds of colony ships now broken out. That's a cool idea.
We're going to take that.
Do you want us to write it for you?
But actually, it's interesting because we discussed a similar idea to what you were talking about some time ago, doing a prequel to Coriolis where you actually play the crew on Nadir you play to explore what happened to it. And what you mean, because in the game, in Coriolis, no one knows what happened to it. I mean, does it exist? Where did it go? But if you want to do what you could do a game where the whole point of the game is to actually explore that mystery.
Well, as a GM, I've been thinking, where do I let my players find Nadir? What's happened to it?
We actually had that plan as a middle part for the Mercy of the Icons. We had the first part, then you played the Nadir part, and what happened in the second part would affect the third part.
But it's funny, it's true, because Nadir is like the big enigma, which is all. I mean, to be honest, it's also makes us a bit wary of using it because it's. I mean, it's so good just having it there because it's so juicy.
And if you don't tell everyone what actually happened to it, it's probably going to be an anticlimax.
Yeah, it's going to be an anticlimax. It's it just ran out of food.
Yeah, they all died.
Everyone's dead.
There was a supernova on the road.
Tins, like, they didn't have an opener. That's horrible death.
Well, we had a bit of a discussion about it, and then, you know, because I love the idea of the Ark in Mutant. I love the idea of the Stronghold or whatever garrison, whatever it might be called in Forbidden Lands.
Really looking forward to that.
And I do remember when Coriolis was first mooted up on the Kickstarter, thinking, oh wow, I have an arc concept, this ship would be your arc. And actually it hasn't really translated into that.
I know, it's interesting because I remember we talked about it behind the scenes. Like, I remember talking to Thomas and I said, I think people might expect an arc maybe in this game, but we don't have the mechanic. We kind of frame it as like the successor to Mutant Year Zero, but it's kind of different because it's more traditional.
But we had plans of, but it's hard to make. I don't know how to expand the ship.
But it's not really the same thing. It's much more traditional. I think
better circuitry.
I think the problem with that. I think the arc works brilliantly in Mutant Year Zero, but there is a problem with having a base. The problem is that if you have a base, you don't want to stray too far from it. And that kind of inhabits exploration. And in some games, you want people to go out in the black. And then it's not good just having a base you have to return to.
Keep coming back to
No.
I think in its favour, I think the point is, having had that moment in the Kickstarter, thinking, oh yeah, great, this will be the arc, I've been playing Coriolis for at least 6 months, if not 9 months, before I went, hang on, the ship isn't the arc. So I was enjoying it so much that it wasn't actually an issue. It isn't an issue, but it's just whether there's an opportunity there.
But I guess you get something else, right? You get that whole Firefly, the kind of the crew of the ship feeling that you don't really have in Mutant. You don't have the kind of tight-knit group.
The arc, of course, has got antagonists in it as well.
Coriolis, you're more working towards the same goal. Whereas in Mutant, you have lots of factions, and you have, you have more potential of adventures maybe in the arc.
And there's no factions in Coriolis.
almost no. slight.
Of the stuff in the Atlas Companion was actually kind of made to kind of. I mean, it's not comparable to the arc system, but it's. This mishaps and stuff that makes the ship come alive.
Travel mishaps.
You're in a floating tin can, right? And it's a lot of things that can go wrong. And I think
and they frequently do in Dave's campaign.
I'm the engineer, after all.
But I mean, I think that's the lovely part of it. I don't get that in that many other games, that you kind of toy with the electric system or the life support gives up or whatever it may be that happens. Like, you can kind of really, you can really play on that.
Mm. And that's the cool thing, because that was one of our 12 first PDF modules, was about, you know, spaceships and mishaps during the travel, and the travel should be eventful. Shouldn't just, you know, go through the darkness forever and ever, and then you arrive.
But no, I think that's a really important point.
What you're describing is one of the, at least, one of the game design goals we had. I'm not sure we always succeeded with that, but you know, there's a module for a traveler call. I think it's I sent it to you, Rickard, which is the free trader manual or something like that. It's super, super cool. It's like a detailed, it's made in the 80s.
Yeah.
A detailed manual of the inside of a spaceship in Traveler universe, with like in-game descriptions of how everything works.
Okay.
With like pictures. This is the galley. This is where you get food. You press that button. You get that. And it's like, and it's so cool. This is like a cabin. You can, this is the toilet and so on. And
there, just
the immersion factor of that is like crazy.
Yeah.
And something, not exactly like that, is too much. But
that's what we're aiming for with, you know, star.
Yeah, wonders. making walking around in a spaceship. I think that's, for me at least, that's the kind of the holy grail.
Yeah.
Experiencing a spaceship.
Yeah.
I think one of the great things about designing ships, and I love designing ships with the rules in Coriolis, and then I draw the map and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But I love then thinking, okay, I'm walking up the ramp now. I'm imagining.
Yeah.
And there's a computer game called 7 Days to Die, which is like a zombie creation game. But I had a server on that, which was mine, and so basically I used it to build ships.
Yeah.
I didn't worry about the rest of it. I just used it as a creation thing, and then I would take videos of the ships.
Yeah.
And largely it was the online, Paul Withershins was my captain. We were doing an online firefly game.
Yeah.
And we had a ship, and so I went onto my server and built the ship.
Mm.
And
you never showed me that, and I'm the GM.
No, no, it was a bit crap though. That's it didn't come out quite as well as I'd hoped. But again, that whole immersing yourself into imagining what it's like being in the bridge or in the brig.
I think it's a big part of people that like science fiction role playing. Yeah. I mean, it's like, just being able to imagine being in the bridge,
watching space,
and just hearing the humming sounds and so on. I mean, for me, that's why I think for these kind of games, being experiencing the travel is as important as coming to a destination. Or but I don't think we got it perfect with Coriolis, but we tried, and I think we can. But it's, I mean, that's the ambition.
I think you've got pretty damn close, actually, as a player and as a GM. And using the Atlas Compendium and all the rest of it. Going back slightly, one of the things that really drew me to Mutant Year Zero, which really applies well for Coriolis as well, is you could craft a scenario using the rules about rolling up systems or rolling up the zones that would fit into a 3.5-4 hour session down the pub.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
Rather than needing a whole Saturday or something. Yeah. And I love that, because that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I was getting into.
I think that's one of the core principles we have, and I think that's how we game as well, because, I mean, getting older, time is the most precious. I mean, and having something, you can take a character sheet, you can make a character in 5 minutes, but you have kind of some relationships, and you play a session, and it feels like a full session in like 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for us, that's the way you want to go.
Yeah, and I think you really hit the sweet spot.
Yeah,
on certainly Mutant and Coriolis for that.
So what I found really interesting there is something that you've done a lot of in your campaign, and I haven't done so much of. You know, their design goal of really trying to make shipboard life an interesting living thing.
Yeah,
as opposed to simply making the ship the ark as. They might have done as something you're developing,
or the Oasis, as they call it,
or the Oasis, and of course, you spend a lot of time on board ship, more time than my players, which is you, have, and I kind of regret not spending a bit more time shipboard with you guys.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword in that you to make the most of it. I've found you do need to play fairly regularly, quite frequently. And obviously, we've played a few games of Coriolis because we've squeezed them in for your campaign. Matt. But actually, on our normal routine run-of-the-mill...
we might only play two or three times a year.
Exactly, yeah. So it'll be harder because then you'll be taking a lot longer to get to your objective.
Yes.
So in my campaign now, we've now played 10 scenarios and they still haven't reached Odacon, which is their end destination. They're very close now. They're one jump away, but they aren't quite there yet. But that's been great. I mean, having the campaign being almost the journey rather than the destination is really good for me as a referee, because it allows you to do lots of different things. There's loads of different scenarios and games you can run. They have NPCs on board the ship with them, and they interact with them, and there's some mystery around some of them, and one of them has a relationship with one of the NPCs, and how's all that going to play out? But then on the other hand, it means that there's pressure on me as the GM to make the final climax, you know, the last episode of the season, you know, them finding their mission, really, really good. Because otherwise, they've had all this bloody journey. They've spent 6 months, 9 months playing the game to get there. It's got to be a damn good denouement at the end of that. Otherwise, it's going to be, oh, is that it?
Yeah, it's got to be a really powerful... It could so easily be an anticlimax, which is the fear I think every GM has of the last scenario in their campaign.
But yeah.
You're probably right. It's really doubled for you.
But also, I mean, it's... I think the other thing is certainly with Coriolis... and how dangerous it can be. You run the risk of killing characters off in a long journey to get to what was the first mission they've ever been sent on. It won't be too big a spoiler, I hope, to say that in my campaign, one of the characters has died in this journey out to Odacon. And you know, I'll give the details, you know, next time. But you know, I was thinking, you know, you could get to. Could get to the end scenario, you know, the final mission, and half the group would be different. You know, if not, in theory, it could all be different. You know, if they take a risky approach to the problems that they're facing, and so that's something that could easily spoil. It'd be like you know, watching Firefly, but by the end of the season, you know, Jane, Mal, and Kaylee are all dead and have been replaced by somebody else. So
yeah.
It does require a bit of management, I think, just to make sure that... maybe I've spent too long on getting them there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that could... You know, it might be that the next campaign you run, people want to have a more home-based campaign. But I'm just thinking... I mean, it's... We talked a little bit about this in the interview, and I think I cut it out because I didn't want to bore these guys. but, you know, we talked a bit about your campaign for... Serenity RPG back in the day, which was based around Tanner's Hold. You know, it was set on a world, and it was about the living in a community, and that community expanding, and it impacts on that. Yes, we went into space occasionally, but the main focus was on a single location. And so you did that in one science fiction campaign.
Yeah.
This might be your next science fiction campaign. I don't think there was anything in between. So there are two contrasting campaigns there, and your next campaign in Coriolis might well be, you know, world based again, or all actually happening on Coriolis.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, that campaign with Tannen's Hold worked really, really well in the Serenity / Firefly universe. I think the things that makes it harder to do that in Coriolis is the cost and the expense of actually flying anywhere. So if you are going to go to, you know, a different system or a couple of systems down the line, actually in time that might not take you very long. It's only a couple of jumps. It might be a few days flying down to the portals and then a few days flying at the other end. But you're still maybe only talking a couple of weeks. But the cost could be 10, 15, 20,000 birr to get there and back. And that's not an insignificant amount of money. So maybe there is, in my mind, there was that feeling that kind of limits... you're going backwards and forwards, kind of home-based scenario or campaign. Whereas going on a long journey, you're making your money as you go in order to do the next leg of the journey. And it's more of an odyssey rather than backward and forward. I wonder... I just had a thought. Sorry, very briefly. Maybe there's something in the horizon where you get like a portal license or a portal... what do you call it? Like a pass or something. And actually... only certain really important people get it, but if you could get hold of one, it gives you free passage through the portals. Just a quick aside.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I was just about to say that what I, you know, what I like about what I've heard from, you know, your campaign and the rules is it has been a struggle for your guys to get the money together.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the slight frustrations I always had with Traveller was we used to get quite rich quite quickly.
Yeah.
And not have stuff to spend the money on. And, you know, this feels more Firefly-like in terms of that expenditure. I know, you know, you're always complaining that my patrons don't pay you enough for your adventures.
Yes.
But, you know, they pay you enough to get through the portals, and, you know, you've got a few burr left over to buy yourself a couple of beers afterwards.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're complaining about, frankly. life in space is tough.
Yeah.
And that was, I'm just remembering that, you know, that's what Martin said about the first version of Coriolis. It was meant to be, space was meant to be like the desert.
Yeah.
A really tough environment. It is a tough environment for modern day astronauts. And it's tough financially for your guys. I'm really loving the way you've done it.
No, cool.
I hand waved, if you'll recall, in the last adventure we played, I hand waved you all the way to Mirror pretty much by not even rolling on the mishaps table to see whether anything happened on those jumps. Partly because I'd offered you three options and you went for the one that I thought you were least likely to take.
like to be as difficult as possible.
Maybe what I should have done is make your journey hell so and put you off taking that option.
Well, have me dead before I get there.
But the way I was thinking about it is, well, let's get them, you know, let's get that thing out of their way and then they can come back to Coriolis and do their thing. Although, actually, you know, you then did other things as well. Like, you're all... I don't know. I'm going to spoil this because I'm not sure whether we'll be producing this as a podcast because I think I might have screwed up the recording. I still haven't listened to it yet. Though. That's Christmas for you. But I will spoil it. You've all ended up in hospital. You're all really badly injured.
And under arrest.
And under arrest, yeah. I mean, how am I going to get you out of that? I've got some ideas about how I'm going to get you out of that. But you weren't particularly saved by the other players because the scenario I ran at Dragonmeat was a follow-on from that situation.
Yeah,
and they came and interviewed you, but they didn't do anything with you. And I realise that actually, again, I say you took the wrong turning. There are no wrong turnings. But what I thought you'd do, having made friends with the woman from the Daughters of the the Weeping Matriarchy is the word I'm trying to say.
get there in the end.
Then when you're hired to nick something from the Weeping Matriarchy, I thought you were going to go and work with her to find out who was asking you to nick the stuff. Maybe fake the nicking. But no, you actually nicked the book and then got into all the trouble you got into.
Yeah, well, it's funny, isn't it? I guess as a little aside about, you know, GMs thinking that they've given an obvious clue or a real pointer and it's something that the players will do, but then they actually don't do it.
I just assumed that that's what you're doing. I don't know I gave you the clue to it. Maybe I should have done. But I do remember in saying at some point, oh, finally you're talking to her. But it was only so you could case the joint, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Didn't tell her. No, but I was going to say in the Pendragon game that Andy ran for us on our weekend away, my son had been disappeared or had been kidnapped. And he'd left a rumour that he'd been found somewhere on the south coast of Anglia a month ago or 6 weeks ago, assuming that I would immediately run off and chase down the lead. And I just thought, 6 weeks, he could be anywhere now and carried on doing what I was doing.
So, well, the other one I'm really cursing is the fact that I guessed exactly what your son had happened to your son pretty much very early on in the game and almost had it confirmed by his brother, I think. But I misread what Andy told me about what his brother's behaviour was, so I didn't pick up on the fact that he was actually saying, yes, you're entirely right. Never expect players to understand your carefully laid clues or railway tracks.
Or follow them ever.
Yes, ever.
Exactly, yeah.
But still, you know, we got ourselves, you know, it was a great fight, and we've got ourselves in a different situation now, and I'm not sure you're going to be bounty hunters from now on, though. We're going to have to think very carefully about that. But we should get back to the interview.
Yes, absolutely. So we had I think the next part of the interview was talking a bit about Mercy of the Icons, wasn't it? And Rickard's experience and his perspective on doing that.
We've got Rickard here. We've talked a lot about the Mercy of the Icons, which must be surely Friele Gann's longest running project.
It is.
It's about to reach fruition. I want to hear more about Mercy of the Icons.
Yeah.
Yes, Rickard,
absolutely.
I've got to admit, you sent us a bunch of stuff. Thank you very much for that.
Epilogue, right?
What the fuck?
Yeah. But don't worry, it was all in Swedish.
Yeah, exactly.
And sadly, Dave's wife was too busy to translate it. So
having come back from holiday, her work was...
Did you sign the NDA? God damn, man.
So we only sent it to five or six other gaming
It's all out
there. It's up on Lulu.
It is top secret. It's only between us, and we haven't read it. So
I tried to, but my Swedish isn't that good. No. Too much. So.
But I'm really keen to hear about Mercy of the Icons. I'm quite keen for the upcoming prequel adventure. When is that?
The Last Voyage of Ghazali.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually, and to be honest, The Last Voyage of Ghazali is another one of the what do you say, inheritances of Jan Ringen, which Rickard did a great job on improving.
Christian worked a lot of that.
Christian as well.
Exactly. He rewrote it, right?
Yeah.
And then
he did.
At the last minute, because I was starting to write Mercy of the Icons stuff by then. So I just made sure that they connected.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
So there is you don't have to play it.
No.
But
it's much more meatier than the first. Yeah. The first version was very bare bones, and the new version is more meatier.
And a cooler ship.
Yeah. There's one problem here. I just gotta admit it, because we did the Dying Ship, and then we did the Last Voyage of Ghazalis. The problem is both of those are of space going under in the space. It's a little bit, maybe we should have wired us, but
then the Dark Flowers is not a space. But let me tell you about Mercy of the Icons,
because
we got the first version in when we started as Freya Liga
2008,
and it was called what's the English title for MSR som försvann?
Literally it's the emissary who disappeared, but it doesn't sound good in English. It sounds good in Swedish.
It's been translated to something else now.
Not a bad title. No. Well, it's quite good to have quirky
titles. It's a good one with the Swedish emissaries of Svan, is that it's alludes to Valerian, you know, the Valerian comic.
Yeah.
There's like a classic Valerian comic that was called in Swedish.
Ambassador.
The Ambassador. Who disappeared.
Right.
So it's just, you get the right feeling of just hearing it.
Yeah.
But in English, you lose it. So that's why we don't use it.
By the way, we got the version called The Emissary 0.085.
Yeah. And that was like 8-7 years
ago. Yeah. With the old rules. And we had that. And then we started discussing how to rewrite that.
The problem with that scenario, the campaign, was that it was a super cool plot in the background. But the ones that was player facing was nothing. The GM, and when you read it, you're like, oh, this is cool. It's like a really big plot. And that's
what you have to look forward to.
Yeah, and,
really
and
cool
the actual, but the adventures were pretty short, and they were all in Coriolis Station, and nothing really happened that much.
No, they were all just on the station, which it was like, damn, we want to see, you know, the wonders of
it
the horizon.
It wasn't
like
So that was, and actually I think that's, I mean, you shouldn't talk crap about the first edition. Because, I mean, Jan Ringen did the original work. So
straight,
they're,
you know,
they're brilliant.
You did.
But I think one of the problems with the first edition was that it was too focused on the Coriolis Station, and it ignored the rest of the Third Horizon.
Yeah.
And I think what we did, at least, was to, well,
open up.
Yeah. This is the Third Horizon. Go wherever you want.
Yeah,
you
know, go and
that's
explore.
What
yeah.
we, go
yeah.
explore.
Yeah.
That's what I thought was the original problem with the first of the Icons. Yeah.
But then we rewrote it, and we sort of thought we should add a part, not expanding the horizon, add a part going down to the Cua planet.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
So we have one part on the Cua planet, and then we had the end part.
Yeah.
And then we had a freelancer who still works for us and has written The Pillar of the Quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote, we gave him a sort of script, write this and this. And he expanded even more. And then I sort of started to edit his stuff.
Yeah.
And it took a lot of time. And then we called some dude You can't point on a podcast. Yeah. Anyway, yes. And he's continued editing. But he didn't just edit. He added a lot of stuff. So you can't be editor. You have to be writer too. It's going to be a problem with the first page, Zach.
I don't want to talk to Thomas about that, actually. So that's okay. But I was brought in as editor. I thought I was going to do completely different things, but then just Costa, you just told me that, hey, how about taking over this campaign thing?
Yeah. Because they're not satisfied with my...
Yeah. And at first...
I'm a physician, too. Yeah. I save lives.
That's a good job.
It's a worthwhile job.
I remember being really diplomatic at the start, just going into, like, making little comments in the document. I was like, could we change this a little bit, maybe? And maybe this, and maybe this.
How long did that last?
2 days, maybe.
Then I stopped following all the fucking comments.
Fix it.
You can edit straight into the documents. Like, so I can write new stuff. Yeah, it's yours now. Essentially, kind of dumping it in my lap, and then I started.
No, I'm just giving you a gift.
Delegating.
Dumping sounds like, you know.
Yeah, so harsh.
Shit.
We've had the odd
Well,
it started out as editing, and then since it's it was quite a lot of kind of factions and a lot of kind of meatiness in the background, and we had felt that had to be cleaned out a bit.
Yeah.
So it's been cleared a little bit, and we've also kind of connected it to a kind of the grander scheme of things. So there is a lot more. I think a key aspect for me was to not just give the players and the GMs just that story. So there is a lot of we extended the introduction chapter quite a lot, so there is a lot of stuff there that should spark some imagination for your like GMs for your own adventures, essentially. And then the different locations that the campaign is going to are also kind of expanded a bit more than just what you need for the adventure. So the point is that, at least from my side of things, is that you should be able to get the mercy of the icons and not really play the campaign if you don't wish to do that, but you can kind of engage in each section, each place, each location of the
world. A compendium element to it.
It is. And part of that is actually it's based on the fact that Costa had written the basement for Coriolis. And there's part of the adventure going down into the basement. Right. And I was so intrigued by that place. I was saying, like, there's a lot of text here. But I personally, when I read it the first time, was like, I really want to go down here and spend, like, countless adventures in the basement. Right? So then that kind of started to get applied to all of the locations that you visit throughout the campaign. And then we rewrote the second part quite a lot.
Yeah, and we also added, and you added a lot of, we wanted to add a part where you should get sparks to continue playing adventures between the first part of the Mercy and the second.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have to, you know, I have to wait for another 2 years now because Freeligan has a lot of secret projects. So we had the plan to add micro adventures, and then you added the you know, you merged that with the each part should have an icon.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going in there. I think.
So is this the icon?
The
adventure generation table.
Yes. This is the epilogue. So at part of the epilogue, word count and number of pages, not my strong suit.
That was the point from the beginning, you know. It was too long.
I totally failed at my initial.
Make it shorter.
I totally failed.
I could have done that.
Totally failed. Sorry about that. But I think it turned into something really cool. And part of that would be the epilogue is meant to kind of bring you out of the. This is kind of a teaser in a sense, right?
Mm.
The adventure is kind of setting stage for something greater. And I really wanted coming out of that for, and we talked about it, like you should explore the emissaries, really. So that's why there had to be an emissary generator in there.
Mm-hmm.
Really fun to write insanity tables and stuff like that. Oh. And there are new powers and stuff, inspired partly from conversation you've had in your pod, actually.
About tier-based. Yes.
Ah,
so that's in there as well. And then we wanted to give a couple of kind of seeds for adventures. So there are, you can kind of create your own emissary adventure from that. There's a bunch of tables for that. And then you can also, a few of them suggest you going back to places that you've played in the adventures.
The
and kind of explore those further and explore mysteries that you're just kind of touching up on in the campaign, but then you, as a GM, you can kind of build upon those stories yourself. So that's kind of cool. I said that it's going to be like 6 pages.
Mm.
That was my original.
As the epilogue.
Yeah. It's not quite.
We have to revise the page count again.
cut this. No, Christian actually said that the layout guy, he said that we're going to try to make it fit. So,
yeah, cool. So, Ricard, you've written it. It's now in layout and I guess into translation into English. It's going to take some months for that to happen.
Yeah, we're actually aiming for a Christmas release in Swedish, but we just missed that, so January.
Right, okay. So January in Swedish.
Yeah, and English shortly after. So.
So, from what you're saying, that's not going to be another Kickstarter campaign. That's going to be a release out on.
I think Thomas we discussed that with him, and we haven't decided.
I'm really excited about most of the icons, and I can't wait to get my hands on it and see what it's all about.
No, you can't. No. Because I'm going to run this. I think this fits in really well.
Again?
With your characters. Yeah. No.
How many of these things?
So if you remember.
Go on.
I was going to. So the last thing that came out, the last voyage of the Ghazali, I said I wasn't going to run and you could run that one. You're thinking back to Alam's Ravine, where I said, don't look at that one because I want to run that.
But you haven't run that one yet, have you?
No, I haven't run that one because you went off in the wrong direction.
So this is two great Freeligan productions that you are telling me I'm not allowed to have. You're worse than my wife saying, oh, you're not buying that on Amazon, are you?
Well, hold on, but you made me run Coriolis in the first place, remember?
Well, I didn't make you. I advised you that you'd be a madman if you didn't play it and run it.
No. I said, oh, so you want me, I'll get a PDF of this so that I can play in your campaign. And you said, no, I'm not running this campaign. You are. So there, I'm running the campaign. It's finally coming out. I get to read it first. But I have to say, it is also looking like a thing of beauty. Have you seen the picture
that's
been doing the rounds on the internet?
I have. It's yet another fabulous piece of artwork. And it's just fabulous. Really cool.
Gorgeous.
Really cool.
Really gorgeous. If anybody hasn't seen it, check out our Facebook page because I reposted it there. I don't know whether anybody's put it up on the G+ one at all.
I haven't noticed. No. I don't think so, but yeah, we should do that. It looks brilliant.
Yeah.
It's really another fabulous bit of iconic artwork.
Yeah. Now they finished off, and I've cut that interview quite short actually because they finished talking about that, and then moved on to talking about Kickstarter.
Mm.
But they said they probably weren't going to publish this as a Kickstarter, so it'll be coming, I imagine, first of all as a PDF, and shortly afterwards in print into the shops. They got into a really interesting discussion about Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And you and I have been really impressed by how professional their Kickstarters have been, how they've not overpromised.
Yeah.
But that wasn't always the case.
Because we have a problem with Coriolis Kickstarters. We keep adding stuff.
They're too damn successful. Is that what you're saying?
They were one of the first ones. We used to be.
You were high.
We kind of burned ourselves. The Swedish Coriolis Kickstarter, we burned ourselves pretty bad.
We haven't produced everything yet.
No, we still. We promised
that.
A damn cookbook.
Cookbook.
We're doing a cookbook. Mahib's cookbook.
Which costs eight
recipes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we promised a book.
It's a cook pamphlet.
It's called cookbook, but it's just like the pamphlet in the book.
It can't be eight recipes.
Because it's setting too, about you know how to use your stasis capsule to do moldy cheese and stuff.
So one is hummus. Yeah. The next one is
it's kebab. It's falafel. Yeah, exactly.
I'm liking this as well. Though. Yeah. Stasis capsules as cooking instruments.
Yeah, you
well.
Know you make Roquefort cheese in your stasis capsule.
I think that's actually a good.
Yeah, that's a good story.
I mean, the point is to actually connect it to the world. So I mean, it is meaty and nice.
So this is really interesting. I just want to touch on this. We in the English speaking world have been so impressed with Frelinghuis's, shall we say, control over their Kickstarters. You know, it's been apparent to us that you haven't overpromised, and you know, Chaosium almost went bust. Well, they went bust, actually, to be honest, over the Call of Cthulhu one. Yeah. Luckily, some fans with lots of money bailed them out and ran the company down.
Yeah.
It's so easy for Kickstarter to go that wrong way. Yeah. And what you're telling us now, which I think is a bit of a scoop for us on this podcast here, is that control and excellent Kickstarter stuff that us English speakers think that you do is a lesson you learned in Swedish.
Yes, it is. That's true.
Yeah. No, in Coriolis.
Not just in Swedish. We have two big, how should we say it? Two big Kickstarters that was huge lessons for us. The first one was actually in English. It was the first Tales from the Loop art books in English, which turned out to be enormous. I mean, it was a big success, but it took us so much more. I mean, we couldn't handle it. It was so complicated.
Yeah, it was two books too.
Two books, which we wouldn't do it. Double shipping. I mean, shipping an art book to Japan is like $65, and we charged like $35 for the books. So we lost. I mean, and also doing that twice, and
all the merchandise.
We have merchandise for everything.
Cups, hold on to those cups.
All the mistakes you can do.
Value. They're gonna be rare items.
Yeah,
and we cups. Again, that's the thing that actually I think almost tipped KSM over the edge.
We learned that merchandise is not a good thing to do because it adds so much.
Overhead
everything that you have to actually ship and produce takes away effort from your core product. So after that, the Coriolis and the Swedish Coriolis Kickstarter, where we got so happy that people still love Coriolis, so we're like, we're adding this and this,
Atlas Compendium and new Atlas, new Bestiary, whatever.
And we were like, cookbook. We were like high. They were like high on the response.
Yeah.
So, but those two taught us that we're still. I mean. Doing stuff for the Swedish Kickstarter.
Mm. Yeah, but a lot of years later. All the text is actually written.
Yeah.
Except the cookbook.
Yeah.
And the mini scenario, the algebra of the icons.
Yeah.
That sounds good. I'm writing that.
Is that going to take as long as The Mercy of the Icons?
Yeah. No. I remember this being actually a title Costa come up with like in 2009.
Yeah, because it's a good title. Yeah. It's not my. It's not my idea. It's actually from a Greg Egan book.
Yeah,
I was a company called the Industrial Algebra. Making
when you said
software for missiles and stuff.
Bad
shit.
Yeah, so I have no idea what it's going to contain, but you know the title.
No. There's
a lot to be said for having a good title. There's and then filling in the rest later.
There's an intelligence called Lazarus.
Wait, Lazarus like in Interstellar?
No, Lazarus like in the Bible. Okay, figure it out.
No, but you're right. Yeah. We did screw up two Kickstarters, but we learned. So we after that we try to keep all our Kickstarters very very lean. And also try to be
because we added a lot of stuff to this first Swedish Mutant too. We had a lot of stuff that went into zone compendiums,
which we took
years to produce.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And that's the problem when you have like a Kickstarter, and it's like, oh, I want this, and people are like, where is the GM screen? I want that, and we're like, well, what should we do? Should we give them something, or should we? Because we know we are just adding a lot of work to another big pile of work.
Let's give them a free license for something.
So they can do their own content.
Just make
good
it.
Idea.
Do anything you like.
Let's just hear that.
I guess there are things also that there will be a stretch goal that might be a really fabulous idea all the fans would love, but it would actually be, as you said, like either no profit or little profit, or even a loss for you. So you're like kind of avoid
committing to those kind of things.
Yeah, we're even all about
the fans
process.
Might love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that much about. I mean, of course, we do the stuff we promise. We try to turn into products even after. I mean, like for example, the Atlas Compendium. Or, mm-hmm. I mean, there's we had promised 3 different atlases for Swedish guys.
Yeah,
and also for I don't remember. I mean, we try to utilize them as products as well, because otherwise it would be stupid. We can't just produce, because we have so limited of bandwidth, we have to try to, well, make stuff that we can live off as well.
Yeah.
But
or Nisa at least.
At Thomas, least me, yeah. And Christian. Yeah. But I mean, for example, soundtracks is a thing that's pretty easy to do, because it doesn't, we don't have to do it. We just hire a freelancer. We hire a musician that does it. And that's good, because then we can, and it doesn't, you don't have to ship it.
Yeah.
So stuff like that, stuff that's abstract but usable.
Yes.
That's what's good. That's the kind of stuff we try to find that we can do without disrupting normal production.
We actually sold our first game as a USB card.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
So I think we've probably asked all the questions, and you've been really good with telling us all the answers we could possibly want.
Yeah. Except for the secret ones.
Except for the secret ones.
Which we're not allowed to talk about.
I guess, David, is there anything else we should have asked?
I think we've gone through our list.
Yeah, this has been great, and your podcast has been really inspiring as well.
Yeah, it's really
actually
good.
Listened to it. So.
But thank you very much, guys. So delighted to meet you. It's been a real pleasure.
If we make a new rulebook, we'll have a hammam instead of a haibs. I promise. Your hammam.
Well, I'd just like to wrap all that up with saying that that's the end of the interviews that we had with Nils Costa and Rickard from Free Illegan. And just to say another great, huge thank you to all the guys for being so such great hosts and such great fun and talking so candidly about stuff. I think next time, if there is a next time, but hopefully there will be, we would love to also get the chance to meet Thomas as well, who's obviously another key member of the team. And I can't wait to be sitting in the Bishop's Arms in Gamlestaden in Stockholm again. Maybe later this year, if the guys will have us, and we could talk about Forbidden Lands and everything else that's going on in the world of Free Illegan.
Yes, and their secret project, which they wouldn't tell us about this time. We'll have to get them to tell us about that.
We'll have to get them more drunk next time, so we can.
Well, hopefully, maybe it's closer to them being able to talk about it or about to release it or something.
That too. Yes,
they might be really keen to talk to us about it because they're about to do a Kickstarter or something on it.
Yeah.
So we'll try and keep in touch with them and be there in Sweden again, as you say, in that wonderful booth in the Bishop's Arms.
It was great.
On Gamlestaden. Next episode, though.
Well, before you go too far there, Matthew, I've had an idea, and I'm going to set you some homework for the next episode. So,
are you?
Yeah. So, in light of the some of the feedback we had off the survey, which again, thanks to everyone who contributed to that, I think we are going to talk a little bit about have a bit of a debate next time about the Syndicate.
A debate. Right,
I'm going to set you an essay question, so you can lead off. So you can lead off the discussion, and we could talk about it. And
I'm not writing an essay on this.
No, you don't have to.
I'll go away, read up the Syndicate again, and your question
The question is, the Syndicate, are they all bad?
And if I come back and say yes, that would be the shortest segment we've ever had.
Well, if you
remember, I won't. No, okay.
If you remember, it would normally, an essay question would normally say discuss in 2,000 words or more, wouldn't it? So,
I'm going to discuss it with you, but I'm going to do my homework first. So, challenge accepted, Dave.
Excellent. Good.
And so, next week, next time, then you'll hear that discussion and see my glorious victory over Dave in that debate. We'll also, I think, probably have those two little interviewettes, a player in the hammam with Lloyd, and an intro. I mean, it's not a Free League game, and it's but I think it's kind of related to some of the stuff that we can talk about next time with Frederico and his game Nibiru.
Yeah, it's a very similar feel, science fiction kind of setting, which again looks really interesting with a slightly kind of interesting twist. So I think it'll be hopefully interesting to all our listeners to hear a bit more about that Nibiru game.
Yeah, I think if you like Coriolis, you're probably going to like Nibiru as well. So yeah, and we'll be back in a more usual format, I think, next time.
Yeah.
So we might have a talent of the episode or some other stuff too.
Absolutely. I was just going to say also, we would still really welcome people's views and comments on the podcast. And if you have any questions or any thoughts, we're not going to introduce a formal sort of question and answer part of the podcast. But if you do have any questions you'd like us to have a think about or hear our views on, please send them to us in all the usual mechanisms. As I said, you can find us on G+. We're on Facebook. We do have.
We're on Twitter.
Twitter, and we have a
Reddit.
An email that I don't remember off the top of my
head. Our email address is coriolis@fictionsuit.org.
And send them through to us, and we will do our best to have a look at them and talk about them. But
and there's just one other thing, actually, I'd like to say this episode. This is a bit of a surprise, Dave. We haven't talked about this beforehand, but I suddenly remembered it, and I think it might be quite an important thing to say. You and I have both kickstarted Western.
Yes.
And so you will have seen the messages we've had about from Anders Gilbring about his wife Tova,
yep.
Who has previously had a bout of cancer. It's back, and I think the prognosis isn't brilliant for her. And she's really keen that she spends the rest of her allotted time here completing, well, the Western Kickstarter and a bunch of other stuff. And I think that means that basically they're looking for money. So if you're if you want to love Tove, they have a GoFundMe campaign. So if you Google GoFundMe Love Tove, T-O-V-E, then you can go to that campaign. But I don't think, I'm not saying you should give them money, but I think if you are interested in any of the stuff they've done, one of the things I did actually is go and buy their Best of Phoenix volumes, collected editions on DriveThruRPG. It's a really good magazine in PDF format in English. The Best of is all published, is all the English articles or translations into English of the articles. Really nicely put together. And so, yeah, I urge you, if you have any love for Tova and you would like to express that love, then go to gofundme.com/lovetove or go and buy some of their stuff.
Yeah, well said, Matthew, well said. And obviously all our best wishes are with Tova at this at this time. But yes, everyone, please go ahead and go to the GoFundMe page and contribute. That would be great.
Cool. Okay, so I didn't want to bring the episode to an end on such a downer, but actually I think probably we ought to have said that. So
I agree. Yeah.
But I think we'll come back in a happier mood in the next episode, and we'll have our challenge.
Indeed. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
And may the icons bless your adventures.
You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by FontFabric.